So yeah, you saw my post about today then.
I did. It does not sound like you had a fun day.
I did not. I'm looking forward to drinking.
That is, yes, I am also looking forward to drinking. I had a frustrating class where students were just not really into trying to pick apart the logic of a small n comparative case study article and fill in Mills method boxes. And it's really hard to keep the energy up on Zoom. So when you're in a classroom, at least you can move around a little bit. You can write stuff on the board. Very stultifying to have to do that in a seated position in your basement when you haven't left your basement in 11 and a half months. So, you know, it's getting old. Pandemic is really getting old.
I got nothing to add.
So do we want to start with an open? Like, do you want an intro to begin with?
Yeah, why don't you do the honors this time? Why don't you say, welcome to Whiskey and IR? Whiskey and IR. Why don't you say, welcome to Whiskey and IR Theory, or whatever you want to say about that. I'm Patrick Jackson, and I'm Dan Nexon. And we'll just go from there. I mean, like, really, we should script this out if we were really professional. So what do you want to say?
Part of the shtick is that we're not. So I think it's fine for us to not be necessarily too professional.
Well, you know, I always fall into this, like, another action-packed episode of Whiskey and IR Theory. Or what's another one that I...
Last time on Whiskey and IR. No.
Well, seriously, last time on Whiskey and IR, we discussed... You Just Don't Understand, a feminist critique of liberal theory, and now we're reading a realist critique of liberal theory, so...
There's some continuity, and also, I think you just...
No,
you,
actually, we're reading old shit from the 90s. That's the continuity.
That is continuity. It is old shit from the 90s, right. But also, this article is a great example of You Just Don't Understand. So, I think there's definitely some thematic overlap here, too.
I do think that it is important to note that we are on a 90s kick.
Yes, we are. Yes, we
are. Is it time for 90s nostalgia yet?
Let's see. That would be, it's about 20 years. Yeah.
I think this cycle is 30 years.
Is it 30 years now for nostalgia, or is it 20? I'm not sure.
Well, it's a generation. So the idea is that when we were in elementary school, our parents had like 50s nostalgia going on.
Okay.
And when our kids were in elementary school, it was like, there was like this 80s revival, things like Stranger Things.
Right.
So now I guess we're due for a 90s revival.
Possibly, although in my pop culture class this week, we were talking about music, and I had the students bring in music that they thought had political relevance of various kinds, and several of them brought in tracks from the mid-80s, and it was old-fashioned classic rock to them, and it was like Tears for Fears. And this made me feel very old. On the other hand, being able to explain to them the Cold War context of songs like Everybody Wants to Rule the World is quite fun. So, because of course they have no memory of this, because this is ancient history to them, right? The 1980s is somewhere close to Rome in their historical consciousness. So,
but because they live on Spotify, they have a phenomenal amount of musical literacy, including... a fairly extensive knowledge, I find, of 80s pop.
It was quite striking that I recognized a good third to a half of the songs that the students had brought in. Sometimes when I've done this particular drill, I have no idea. And they're naming artists that, of course, they're all nodding their heads at, and I have no idea who these people are. But a number of them brought in folks that not only did I know, but folks that I listened to. In fact, Tears for Fears, Songs of the Big Chair, was one of the first albums I ever purchased with my own money. And so, since that came up in class, I then got to talk about that and explain to them what a cassette was and how you use them.
So let's get this show on the road.
All right, so let's do this. And welcome to another exciting episode of Whiskey and International Relations Theory. I am one of your co-hosts, Patrick Thaddeus Jackson.
And I'm Dan Nexon, your other co-host and the person who usually introduces the podcast, so we thought we'd mix it up a bit.
Nothing like doing a little bit of role reversal to get things started. We've been doing this now for, what, almost a year now, I think.
Almost a year.
So this is almost our anniversary episode. And
every episode's an anniversary episode, Patrick.
Well, it's an anniversary of something. That's true. But it is interesting to think that we have been doing this for almost a year now, because we started this right about when the crazy quarantine lockdowns started here in our area. And that means that we've been going through lockdowns and quarantines for about a year, too.
Yeah, well, there it is. So we are continuing the theme of doing greatest hits from the 1990s.
That's right.
And today we are going to be talking about the False Promise of International Institutions, a John Mearsheimer article. Mearsheimer was very well known at the time, but he's a lot more famous now than he was then. This is well before the tragedy of great power politics and Mearsheimer's rocket to superstardom status. Although, like all of his work, this is pugnacious, declarative, self-assured.
I think those are all excellent adjectives to describe Mearsheimer's style.
But this was actually quite controversial when it came out, and what we're going to do on the next episode is discuss the responses to it that International Security published in a follow-up issue. This cat is really making my... I can't move her. She loves me too much. This cat is making it very hard for me to focus. We are going to discuss the debate that happened in the pages of International Security over this article, which included Alex Wendt. Who else did it include? Do you remember?
Yes, John Ruggie was part of that. Robert Cohane and Lisa Martin, and also Charlie Kupchan and his brother. And that, I think that's the whole, and there's a response by Mearsheimer himself to that. If I remember right, that response was being written during my first year at Columbia, because I think I remember talking to John Ruggie about it as he was writing it. So it was a big deal. It was a big deal for people like Wendt and Ruggie to appear in the pages of International Security in 1995. That was significant.
I mean, also in that era, we did have this whole kind of Clash of the Titans phenomena that I don't think we really have anymore.
Not quite the same way. I used to, it's funny, when I first started teaching PhD students, I used to tell PhD students that when you go to the International Studies Association meeting, there are certain shows you should try to catch. And they would be these big names who would be putting on sort of command performances. And Mearsheimer, the Mearsheimer show, I always said was one that you should go and see, because he was an amazingly witty and blunt at the same time. Blunt and witty debater, put on a very interesting performance. But he was definitely one of the celebrated realists, right? He was one of the people who was, it's not too much of an exaggeration to say, kind of a realist champion. And that's definitely what this piece has the feel of. Somebody riding into battle against their opponents and trying to slay them as efficiently as possible.
Well, it's a rerun of the greatest hits of realism, because after all, it's a critique of the kind of woolly-eyed idealism that is supposed to have screwed us up in the interwar period, and that we're about, apparently, on the brink to do again after the Cold War.
Amazing how the names of the opponents may change a little bit, but the charges leveled against them remain pretty constant for a certain kind of American IR realism. So it doesn't matter whether we're talking about idealists, or we're talking about institutionalists, as Mearsheimer calls them, or we're talking about constructivists or whoever else, it's the same charges all the time. And realism is the only thing that can get us through, because it is the only tradition that has access to the profound and terrible truth of how awfully violent international relations is.
Well, I know that the paradigms aren't sexy anymore, and there are a couple times in my notes where I've written, wow, I can't imagine why people got bored of this. But that being said, I was talking through some sort of stylized histories with my class this afternoon of the field, and they're fresh grad students. They don't have any idea what happened in 1980, 1990. And then you sort of hit the wall of your own knowledge. Like you get back to the 1950s, and I'm like, well, I've read some IO articles and they're all kind of descriptive. I'm not really sure what else is going on. The realists are around. I know that there must be other things because I've read references to them. But even if you look at sort of the central debates of American IR up through the present, whether or not we call it realism and liberalism, we're kind of repeating the same axis of debate. What we talk about still pivots around these questions about can forms of international cooperation overcome various pernicious side effects of anarchy? How much global governance is there? How much does it work? How effective is it? Those are really, we're really just kind of in a lot of the same debates. And the subjects have changed. I mean, we're talking about climate change now, as opposed to how to manage empires collectively.
Threat of nuclear war.
Trusteeship.
No, but that is interesting. But there is something kind of perennial about this question. And it's also fascinating, and I'm jumping way ahead here, right? We haven't even gotten to the whiskey, but there's a moment at the end of Mearsheimer's piece where he cites one of the articles that I know we talked about incessantly in graduate school and have used a number of times, that Keith Shimko piece on the liberal tradition in America and how neorealism is a kind of more optimistic version of realism that fits better with American political culture. And in a way, that dialectic, shall we say, encapsulates and covers an awful lot of what actually goes on in IR theory debates. There's the, for lack of a better word, let's call it an American progressivist attitude that right reason can somehow tame power politics, either by building institutions or by having a different kind of political culture or something. And then the more pessimistic counter to that, no, it can't. You will never escape the trap. There's no way you can ever actually get out of this problem. And that push and pull seems to run underneath the surface of a lot of the terminological and personnel shifts if you look at these discussions over the course of, gosh, how long has there been IR in the United States? 130, 140 years, if you take Brian Schmidt's account seriously, that you really have to go back and look at this starting out in the 1870s and 80s with people talking about international law and kind of a liberal approach to international law. Still, that's not that long. And that seems to have been the tension all the way through.
You should probably do the thing we always do, which is talk a little bit about John Mearsheimer's biography straight from the pages of Wikipedia, and then also tell us what our whiskey selection for tonight is.
Oh, definitely. I had fun with the whiskey selection. I actually went out and bought a bottle of this specifically for this episode and the next episode, because I'm not going to choose new whiskey for the response pieces. We're just going to keep drinking the same stuff. Let's talk about Mearsheimer's biography a little bit first, and actually not from the pages of Wikipedia this time, instead this time from
Ooh.
John Mearsheimer's very own website, www.mearsheimer.com.
Is that where you have the painting of him as Machiavelli?
There, that painting is there. There is also a picture of him standing with his jacket and not a suit, but a jacket and a pair of dark trousers, and his hands are in his pocket, him sort of glancing off to the side of the camera. But anyway, John Mearsheimer, this is from his website. And he has, and I didn't realize this, I know he'd been at the University of Chicago for a while, but I did not realize he had been at University of Chicago continuously since 1982. So he's been at University of Chicago for a very long time. He graduated from West Point in 1970, served for 5 years as an officer in the U.S. Air Force, and then he started graduate school and got his PhD in political science from Cornell in 1980. So he got his PhD from, what's interesting, because his CV says he got his PhD in 1981, but his website says he got his PhD in 1980. So make of that what you will. And over his long and distinguished career, he has won a variety of awards, teaching awards. He was apparently a Phi Beta Kappa visiting scholar in 1993-94. He's been elected to the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. His most recent honor from the American Political Science Association is the James Madison Award, given to an American political scientist who has made a distinguished scholarly contribution to political science. So Mearsheimer is definitely a well-respected figure in a number of academic circles. He's written, I mean, this CV goes on for a while in terms of books and articles and so on. You had mentioned earlier, and I'm not sure if I'll mention it again, for the book that he's these days most well known for is a book called The Tragedy of Great Power Politics, which I believe came out in 2000 and, was it 2008 when that book came out? No, I'm sorry, 2001, and then there's a new edition in 2014. So the book that came out around 2008 is a book that came out in 2007, which he wrote with Stephen Walt, which is a book called The Israel Lobby in U.S. Foreign Policy, another book that he's fairly well known for. And it's interesting because most of Mearsheimer's work is conducted on the systemic level, talking about states and anarchy. The Israel Lobby book is very much a domestic politics book, and it is a book about the claim that he and Walt make in that book is that the United States foreign policy toward Israel is mostly a function of the power of the Israel lobby domestically and doesn't make any strategic sense. So, and that is an art.
It's essentially exploring deviation from realist ideal policy with reference to domestic politics. It's a fairly standard and fairly controversial strategy in the paradigm sense of, is it something that is supposed to be a defense of realism, or does it indicate that realism has real problems if you're always trying to explain deviation from the benchmark? There's a lot of stuff wrapped up in that. There's also the most recent book, which is all about how liberal ideology compels the United States to do horrible things internationally.
Which is a theme that Mearsheimer has been sounding for a while, actually, in various forms, and we'll see that even in the piece that we're going to talk about this episode. The idea that the real problem here, and it's interesting for someone who is a realist, who is very much convinced that material power is everything, that he casts a lot of the blame on these delusional liberal ideas that lead people astray.
And in fairness, it is 25 years old, and people are allowed to adapt and evolve. But there are a lot of places in this article where I have notations about, I wonder how 2020 Mearsheimer would respond to this argument, which is inconsistent with the book he just wrote, that sort of thing.
Anyone with that long and distinguished of a scholarly career is probably going to have some evolution in their thought.
I can imagine what Mearsheimer would say is he would say that he's still right about the fundamental objective character of the international system. It's just that these delusions are powerful enough to make the United States do bad policy, but as any good structural realist would argue, the United States is punished for that bad policy. It undermines its own security. It provokes balancing behavior by somebody.
By someone. And that's, yeah, that is the question.
I don't know.
And there are some interesting, both in this article and in the responses to it, there are some interesting predictions that, as I was reading, was sort of struck by the fact that 20 years from now, if X has happened, and I thought, oh, actually, we're past that point. So now we can actually evaluate some of these predictions 20 years later and kind of see what happened. But anyway, so Mearsheimer has been around. He is one of the people who has been carrying the flag of realism for a very long time. And he doesn't mince words. Let's put it that way. And he, in a way, I think, would rather have somebody to fight with than somebody who agrees with him. And there's definitely a sense in anything of his that I've read, and in watching him at conferences and such, that he enjoys a good argument. And that is the kind of clashing that I think drips off of the page in this 94-95 piece, for sure. So shall I talk about...
You should talk about the whiskey.
The whiskey. Gotcha. So, in trying to think about what would make sense as a whiskey for Mearsheimer and realism, it occurred to me that realism presents itself as a long-standing tradition, and it presents itself as a tradition that has always been wrapped up with the state and the power of the state. So I've managed to, I went out and I've got, bought a bottle of Glenlivet Founders Reserve. The reason I went with Glenlivet is because Glenlivet is the first distillery in Scotland to have actually received official sanction under the Scotland Act in 1822 to become a licensed producer of whiskey. So they've always been wrapped up with the state and with the power of the state to begin with. And the thing about the Glenlivet that is equally fascinating is at the time, Glenlivet was not a trademark. It was simply the generic term for a bunch of different whiskeys. So the whole bunch of different things floating around that are the Glenlivet this and the Glenlivet that, until these folks, the George Smith and Company group that set this stuff up, they ended up trademarking the term, and then they had to go out and defend the trademark and so on. So it invents a purity out of something that is a lot more chaotic in the beginning. And I thought that was kind of appropriate. And rather than going with regular Glenlivet, I went with the Founders Reserve, because the Founders Reserve has an air of sort of distinguishedness to it, right? This idea of, well, it's not just it's the founders, it's their founding tradition. And of course, realism always presents itself as being the founding tradition of the systematic study of international relations to begin with. So I thought that was kind of appropriate. So plus, I didn't have a bottle of it in the house. And I thought, what a better excuse to go into the Maryland liquor store and pick up a bottle. So I did. And here we go. Now, the Glenlivet Founders Reserve is not an age statement whiskey, so it is, though it is technically a single malt, it is definitely a blend. There are things of different ages in here, but they present themselves as being one, sort of the way the realist tradition likes to present itself as being one thing rather than the agglomeration, when we all know it's actually an agglomeration. So, here we go. What have you got tonight?
I've just got the Dalwhinnie 15. Oh. I don't want to open another bottle.
Hey, so good stuff.
Well, I promised I was going to say something about Mearsheimer, who I don't know super well, but I did have the opportunity to travel with in China, where he was something of a rock star, as he is sort of everywhere he goes, I guess. And he was a really pleasant, fun traveling companion, interesting to talk to. He gave the sort of same presentation I've heard him give before. One thing about him is that he has a tendency to duck the prestige people to talk to students. And so he gives students a lot more time than you might expect your typical superstar academic to give them. So I was at a Georgetown talk that he gave fairly early in my career. Mearsheimer was there, so we had a very large hall. There were hors d'oeuvres served, there was food and drink afterwards, and Mearsheimer was basically the entire time after the talk in the corner with like five or six undergraduates, just talking to them about realism, about IR, asking them questions, letting them ask him questions. When he was in China, he definitely, you know, posed for all the selfies people wanted to take with him at Fudan when we were there, and all that kind of good stuff. So I have heard that he is a phenomenal teacher. I do not doubt it based on the behavior that I have seen.
And he certainly won a series of teaching awards and features those prominently on his website and in his CV. So obviously he takes his teaching very seriously. It's interesting that we talk about him being off with undergrads and such. Who else was like that? Was Hayward Alker. When Hayward was president of the International Studies Association and he was doing his president's tour around to different regional ISAs, he suggested / insisted that there be a meet and greet with students at every one of them. So for when I met him when I was an undergraduate student, and he was out at the ISA Midwest, and that happened to be at the Michigan State that year. And he had a session that was just for students and wanted to just spend time with students and see what they were thinking and talk to them again about the field and about theories and approaches and so on. So very distinctive. There's a certain character of an academic person like that that I think is just fantastic.
And it's very important for us to stress these things because we are not, I would say that this was a trip of nostalgia. It reminded me of all these debates that seemed, as you said, so important when we were in graduate school. And wow, is it a problematic article? So
So
problematic.
problematic, so many misunderstandings, so many oversimplifications. And I think in honor of or in respect of the way that John Mearsheimer engages with people, I don't think we're going to pull punches here.
One of the things that I'm going to say off the bat, because I may mention it every time we get to a note, one of my notes in the margins, this thing is really repetitive.
Yes.
And I think it's actually badly edited because the same sentences appear two paragraphs apart.
And the first time I saw that in this reread, I thought that it was some sort of a stylistic thing. And then it kept happening in ways that didn't seem to advance the argument. So maybe it is bad editing. I don't know.
Well, I say that because I assigned Amitav Acharya's Global IR article to my students last week, and as I was reading it, I noticed that there was a sentence that repeated twice in the same paragraph, and this was particularly embarrassing for me because I edited that piece when I was at ISQ. It was the first presidential address that I ever did, so it's on me. What can you say? All right, so the false promise of international institutions. If you've heard the show before, you know what we do. We go through the article or the book and we talk about it. We try to tackle it in something of a linear fashion. It doesn't always work that way. Articles are a little bit more difficult, but one of the virtues of this article is it's very clearly organized and very, very clearly segmented. So basically, the article begins by saying, look, the Cold War's over, and all these people think that we're going to use liberal internationalism, essentially, to bring about a more peaceful world. So he's quoting Warren Christopher. I think he has Tony Lake in a footnote, democratic enlargement, all that kind of stuff. So it's the Clinton era, and we are going to expand the liberal world. And he
Absolutely.
says, is this return of a kind of Wilsonian optimism justified? And is it a good idea? And the way that he phrases this is interesting because the way that he does the argument is to say he's going to be looking at the claim that institutions can make the world more peaceful. And then he's going to do that by interrogating three different theories of how institutions make the world more peaceful: liberal institutionalism, the theory of collective security, and then critical theory. We'll just stop there for a second.
I think that needs a drink.
Yeah, it does need a drink. In fairness, I think it is not unusual at the time to not know what to make of the explosion of different kinds of social theories and theoretical perspectives that's happening in IR. It's very easy to look back at the mid-90s through the lens of the early 2000s. That is, think about when The Culture of National Security comes out. That's what 90, that's these books are all coming out in like 95, 96. Security Communities is 1998.
Well, hold on. We have to have a little historical consciousness of this. It depends which kind of paradigm wars we're talking about. If we're talking about realism, liberalism, constructivism, yes, that comes late 90s. Before that, it was realism, liberalism, Marxism. And that is going crazy in the 1980s into the early part of the 1990s. There's an interesting way when I was reading this piece, actually, that I wondered if when Mearsheimer says institutions and institutionalism, I found it fascinating that there's no mention of Marxism, but and to the extent that Marxists show up, they show up a little bit in critical theory. But it's this transition period from when the big three used to be realism, liberalism, Marxism to realism, liberalism, something else. Let's set aside collective security for a second, because that's a weird fit in terms of this argument that Mearsheimer wants to make.
Let's just say this. The period that we're talking about now, by the mid-80s, you've got Ashley making active interventions. You've got Alex Wendt in 87 with a piece that already is seen by some people as having skimmed off the best parts of critical theory.
Well, you had Ruggie and Craticwell in 1986.
Extremely important argument about norms and norms as both how do we study them, but also as a challenge to standard quote unquote positivist methodology. Nick Onis' book is in 89, and a lot of this stuff is in gestation for longer.
Yeah, but I remember being at the APSA meeting in 1994, like in my second week of graduate school, because it was in New York. And one of the big events was the Culture National Security Roadshow panel, where it was Wendt and Katzenstein and a couple of others, and Jack Snyder was the discussant. And there were, I think Marty Finnemore was on the panel as well. And it was a presentation of the sort that I know then later happened at places like Minnesota, where they took that same group and went and presented some of those papers. So it would have been gestating during that time. Hold on, let me just check and see what the actual copyright. Yes, it's 1996. Culture National Security was published in 1996, but had been gathering steam for a couple of years prior to that.
But I don't think the triad of realism, constructivism, liberalism is really quite consolidated by now. And I don't think it does consolidate. It doesn't consolidate for people who are in constructivism for like another year or two, maybe. I think, and then, or maybe even longer, right? Till the sort of the later 90s, sometime before Alex's book comes out, because Alex's book, but after some of the big arguments are going on about broadly the social construction of international politics, which is part of why you get this very strange section on critical theory. I think, I mean, I'm being charitable.
No, but I think you're on to something there, because these things hadn't quite congealed yet. Even the term constructivism was just one thing that had been proposed, and it's not the main term that Mearsheimer is operating with, right? He's operating with institutionalism and then critical theory as a particular institutional theory, which is, I have a hard time even saying that sentence, that somehow critical theory is an institutional theory, because what and what? But
We'll
anyway,
get there, man.
I
We'll
know,
get
we'll get
there.
there, we'll get there. But it is important, I think, because we look back and we see these things as already formed, to remember that there is an awful lot of theoretical chaos going on in the early 90s. And there are a lot of different moves being made, and people are going off in all kinds of different ways, and you haven't yet had. Like you've had by this point, you've had Alex Wendt's 1982 piece articulating one kind of sort of a liberal version of constructivism, and then you've had Marty Finnemore writing stuff. You've got the Culture National Security forming, but you haven't gotten to like Emanuel Adler's Seizing the Middle Ground. You haven't got, and I think that's 97. So there's a lot of formation of that constructivist paradigmatic cage in the mid 1990s. And that's not, because if this is published in 94, 95, this is clearly being written a little bit before that. And though that hadn't happened, that process goes on after this arc.
And Mearsheimer is not going to be at the cutting edge. There's a lot of stuff. He's quoting a lot of people, but he's not going to be on the cutting edge, I think, of understanding where the positionality is. And that's obvious from the fact that he lumps it together in the way that he does. So, it opens by citing people like Lake and Warren Christopher about how the liberal institutions that the United States built during the Cold War can now be extended and globalized, and how we can put behind us sort of the power politics of the old way, and use cooperative mechanisms to have a new, more peaceful world, a world that is suitable for this post-Cold War era. He then says that there is a wave of academic interest in institutions that mirrors this, cites Cohen, Ruggie. And so he's going to tell us, like, basically, he's going to play E.H. Carr or Morgenthau. He's going to tell us, look, don't do this. The theories are bad. Their causal logic is flawed. He's giving us a warning. He's saying, realism is still true. The end of the Cold War does not mean that realism is false. And there is a disciplinary context there because, as we've talked about in past episodes, there were a lot of people who said the end of the Cold War put egg on realism's face. This was a huge blow, a huge defeat intellectually for realism was a lot of the line. And this wasn't just, Fritz Kreteauqville and a couple of constructivists or critical theorists. It was people who worked in IPE who were saying that security was going to be irrelevant, that we really didn't need to study security in the security studies way. So there was really a sense that we were kind of, a sense of optimism moving on that was reflected both in, I think, the world writ large. But we are then going to make the mistake, if we follow the notion that institutions can bring about peace and cooperation, we're going to make the same mistakes we've made before. Right? That's essentially what the claim is here. Although he doesn't hype on the interwar period as much of as I assume that he would before I actually reread the introduction.
I think also it's important to remember that this particular subject position, the Cassandra, who explains how things really are but is overlooked by the liberal mainstream, is a role that Mearsheimer has played a lot in his published career. And just a few years before this, in the very same journal, he had written this piece called Back to the Future, which was a dire prediction of the future of European integration, arguing that no, what will happen after the Cold War is done is that the European Union will fray and disappear, and we will end up with going back to the balance of power system classically in Europe, which is sort of a return to the normal status of things. And it's just been a weird interruption that we've been in this sort of period of stability for a while. And that's going to all end now, now the Cold War is done. So that position of being the only one in the room who can see what's really going on and knowing that they're going to be ignored, but feeling that they have to say it anyway, is a role that Mearsheimer plays quite often in print.
Were you involved with the April 1st prank where we
Yes.
papered the IAB with fake flyers for a fake John Mearsheimer talk
Crips, Bloods, and
entitled Back to the Hood? Yeah,
Nukes.
it was called Back to the Hood. And I think we said it was going to be in Bob Jervis's office. That was the room number we gave. It was somebody's office. And apparently a bunch of people showed up, so it was plausible. Part of the reason it was plausible was that Mearsheimer was known for talking about the bully dynamics of Catholic school when he talked about the fundamental truths of realism. So, okay. Anyway, so yes, our glory day is passing us by.
Yes. But I think it's important because realism often and realists often grab that. I'm the misunderstood prophet. I'm the one who really knows what's going on. And gosh, listen to me, but I know you're not really going to, but I'm going to tell you anyway.
The other thing that I think is worth mentioning is that we're going through a moment that's a little bit like this now, right? So I've mentioned this before, I believe, on the podcast, but the whole discourse of quote unquote great power conflict or GPC is really a gloss on a realist critique of the naivety of the pursuit of liberal institutionalism, liberal enlargement, liberal convergence during the post-Cold War era, that we sort of squandered our hegemony by trying to make the world more peaceful and putting our faith in multilateralism and rules. That's the bare bones of the conservative indictment of all of post-Cold War foreign policy, although whether it's indictment of Bush the second or not is a little ambiguous from what I can tell. But it's interesting. I mean, in a sense that we're going through the same set of debates. This is about 25 years. All right. So there are a couple of moves here at the opening that I think are worth noting. One of which is that he makes a claim that the best way to understand this debate and to know whether institutions are going to make the world more peaceful or whether realists are right and this is a pipe dream is to look at general theories. So on he says in the text, this article examines the claim that institutions push states away from war and promote peace. I concentrate on assessing the major international relations theories that employ institutions as a core concept: liberal institutionalism, collective security, and critical theory. I begin, however, with a brief review of realism. Because of the institutionalist theories, what? Yeah, you see, this is what I mean,
That's
editing.
a bit,
I begin, I, okay, this is how it reads. I begin, however, with a brief review of realism because of the institutionalist theories is largely, I think what it's supposed to say is, I begin, however, with a brief review of realism.
Because the institutionalist theory
is largely a response to realism, mm-hmm. and each directly challenges realism's underlying logic. Mm-hmm. And then footnote 11 before then, where he says, he lists the three types, he says, prescriptions about how best to maintain peace should rest on general theories about the causes of war and peace. This point is true for both academics and policymakers. Although policymakers are seldom self-conscious in their use of theory, their views about institutions are nevertheless shaped by their implicit preferences for one theory of international relations over another.
That is actually the first thing that I circled in my own notes, is that footnote in particular.
Okay, well, take it away, so, Patrick.
Well, the immediate thing that struck me here was the equivalence that he wants to draw between what he's calling institutional theory on the one hand and the pro-institutional views of policymakers on the other. And there's something kind of slippery in this notion, because he plays back and forth. On the one hand, he's got theoretical schools that are trying to explain how institutions work and why they would work. And then on the other hand, he has a preference for institutions. And I don't know that you can just slip back and forth between the two of those quite so easily. There are lots of reasons why someone might prefer institutions or might think that an institutional solution to something was a better way to handle it. And I don't know that that necessarily signals any kind of preference for a particular international relations theory the way we've articulated them. And
I mean, this could just be rapacious hegemony, which is an argument which is what he's going to say it is.
Mm-hmm.
Not that, you know, 5 years after this, 6 years after this. So
I think that he's reading in quite a lot to the preference for institutions that he sees in some U.S. politicians. He's reading in a whole lot of interesting theoretical stuff behind it. And that also belies some of what he says a little bit later on, which is that there are realist reasons why one would want to construct institutions. And if there are realist reasons why one would want to construct institutions, why aren't these institutionalist policymakers actually adhering to realism rather than adhering to these liberal theories? So there's something kind of weird here about the way he wants to jump between these two domains.
Didn't Ryan Krebs have an article? It was an article, it was a response piece in Security Studies fairly early on in all our careers, in which he critiqued another Columbia PhD, or he used his article as a springboard for basically saying, look, it's about time realists stop saying that institutions don't work and we start developing realist theories of institutions.
Yes. Was that in Security Studies?
I think it was in Security Studies.
I do faintly remember that. And certainly that's been the argument that Jennifer Sterling Folker, who was one of John Mearsheimer's students, has consistently made throughout her career, that realists should not cede institutional arrangements to liberal and other theories, but realists should develop realist theories of institutions, and not just security institutions, but political economy institutions, which is actually what a lot of her early empirical work was about.
But I think that Ron's point is correct, that there remains not enough attention, not only to theories of institutional formation, but also to theories about how institutions do affect dynamics, but in ways that are consistent with realism or ways that are power political. Mm-hmm. It's interesting, right? This is still in the realm of like realism versus institutions. Although, as you say, a lot of the times he says, there are a lot of times where he says that this is not puzzling that these institutions are doing okay or cooperation is going well. And man, does that require some underlining.
I'm going to say, just one other thing, just to sort of foreshadow a little bit. There's an interesting ambiguity here between realism as like a descriptive ontology of the international system, which has certain kinds of implications for valid or appropriate state action, and realism as an explanatory theory of what states actually do. And that ambiguity is one that is sustained multivocally throughout the piece. He goes back and forth between realism as being a way of talking about what the international system is fundamentally made of, and realism as being a way of explaining what it is that states actually do.
This is a fairly common criticism of realism, that the slipperiness between prescription description, explanation is a way of kind of evading problems for the theory, is the way that people who don't like the realist theory put it. I do want to stress, though, that he says realists and institutionalists particularly disagree about whether institutions markedly affect the prospects for international stability. Realists say no, institutionalists say yes. Realists maintain that institutions are basically a reflection of the distribution of power in the world. They are based on the self-interested calculation of the great powers, and they have no independent effect on state behavior. In other words, they are epiphenomenal. And this is the sort of very strong realist claim that institutions just don't matter. States might set them up, who knows why? Maybe they think they're attractive to look at, you know, the big buildings, but they set them up. But at the end of the day, they do not affect outcomes. This is the position. And he will go back to that position multiple times during the article. And then his central conclusion is that institutions have minimal influence on state behavior, and thus hold little promise for promoting stability in the post-Cold War world. Okay, so the first part of it is a discussion of what are institutions. The next section, and this is on page 8. He defines institutions as social institutions, and he's drawing on regime theory. And one of the things he points out is that institutions and regimes are often that institutions and regimes are often used interchangeably in somebody like Robert Cohen's work. Ergo, he's going to kind of treat them as all the same thing.
And also the term, he says in the footnote 13 there on page 8, the term multilateralism is also virtually synonymous with institution. So he's got multilateralism and institution and regime, and they all kind of mean the same thing.
Right. But that's he's quoting John Ruggie there.
No, but the quote from Ruggie, the term multilateral is an adjective that modifies the noun institution. So multilateralism depicts a generic institutional form in international relations, which isn't to say that all institutions are multilateral, but that multilateralism is a form of institutions.
So having embraced initially the sort of institutionalist view, he then decides to define institutions for him, his own purposes, which are as a set of rules that stipulate the ways in which states should cooperate and compete with each other. They prescribe acceptable forms of state behavior and prescribe unacceptable kinds of behavior. These rules are negotiated by states, and according to many prominent theorists, they entail the mutual acceptance of higher norms, which are, quote, standards of behavior defined in terms of rights and obligations. And then these rules are typically formalized, but they can also be informal. Also of note, on footnote 14, Susan Strange, I think that's the first time he cites a female author.
One of the three, I think, in the piece. So, and then he goes on to say there that not just the rules are typically formalized, but they're usually embodied in organizations with their own personnel and budget. So basically, in about five lines there, he's covered a whole series, he's pushed together a whole series of things that people who study this stuff would want to pull apart and say are really actually very different things. The dynamics of an organization and the dynamics of a set of rules and a set of norms may not be the same at all, and he has really smushed them all together.
He also says something here interesting, which he says it is not the organization per se that compels states to obey the rules. Institutions are not a form of world government. States themselves must choose to obey the rules they created. Institutions, in short, call for the decentralized cooperation of individual sovereign states without any effective mechanisms of command. And there he's citing Stephen, there he's
Lipson.
citing, right. So this is a little bit also funky because he pulls an interesting trick here, which is that he takes the fact, as we'll see, that liberal institutionalists in these neo-neo debates, and we should probably explain a little bit what they are when we get there. In those debates, there was a move by people like Cohen, and he does quote Cohen on this, to try to attack realism on its own turf. The whole argument was internally within the logic of realism, there is still plenty of room for productive cooperation, well beyond what realists would expect. And Mearsheimer uses this as an argument for saying that, in essence, that means the logic of liberal institutionalism is stuck with realism. And when there is a discrepancy between liberal institutionalism and realist logic, that is a problem with liberal institutionalism, which is really quite odd in some ways, right? I mean, it's like a debating trick. It's not a substantively persuasive argument. And it's very frustrating. And here you can see that, how he's stacking the deck already. We're not going to talk about global governance mechanisms. We're not going to talk about governance without government kinds of arguments, although that'll show up a little bit in critical theory very briefly.
And he's also smuggled in the idea that rules in an institutionalist account have to be mutually accepted on the basis of higher norms, which is one explanatory account of why states behave in accordance with rules, but is certainly not the only one. So again, we've got this conflation of a definition of a term, institution, and an explanatory theory of why we have them, kind of all pushed together and made into a what appears to be a seamless whole by strategically quoting from three different kinds of authors. Like he'll follow a Ruggie quote. To follow a Ruggie quote with a Lipson quote and put a Krasner quote in the middle of them, he is synthetically generating his opponent in that paragraph. And having generated that particular scarecrow or Frankenstein monster of an opponent, it's not surprising that he can then find lots of inconsistencies in it and pick it apart.
This is quite amusing if you think about the last 20 years of historiography on the so-called first debate, because the whole argument there is that what realists did, that this vaunted realist idealist debate never happened, that there weren't really people who fit the way that realists were talking about idealism. And so realists had sort of synthesized this idea of idealism out of a whole bunch of different kinds of arguments and policies that were around at the time. And so I guess history really does repeat itself.
Apparently it does. Apparently it does.
The only other note I have here is that what's interesting is that when he talks about formal institutions, international agreements, he defines them as, as you said, embodied in organizations with their own personnel and budgets. That's only true from about the mid-19th century on.
Yeah, this is very much a backward projection of the UN, NATO, and the WTO. That's really what he's talking about here.
And I don't think he's saying that there was, a NATO in 1615. I just think it's sort of, again, it's sort of an interestingly limited purview because later on he will make this big stink about 7 centuries of realist logic. How he defines realism, by and large, with a couple of moves, it's a very clear, straightforward description of the way that I think most realists would describe themselves, right?
No, it's when I was reading through it, it occurred to me that if you could somehow just take those few pages and assign them, then it would be a really great realism 101 for undergraduate students to read and get some good sense of the core of what it is that realists think about things. I would have a hard time assigning this particular article to undergrads, though, because the rest of it is so strange in terms of how it portrays the non-realist parts of things. But in terms of a statement of broad synthetic realism, it's quite clear.
But now let's talk about a couple moves that he makes here. So he gives us five assumptions of realism. These assumptions are things like that the international system is anarchic. The second is that states inherently possess some offensive military capability. The third is that states can never be certain about intentions of other states. The fourth is that the most basic motive driving states is survival. States want to maintain their sovereignty. The fifth assumption is that states think strategically about how to survive in the international system. States are instrumentally rational. Now, here's the thing. These are empirical wagers, they're not assumptions. They are assumptions if what we're talking about is building a artificial analytical model of the world, right? So if we were programming a realist agent-based model, we might put in these assumptions. And then, like Lars-Erik Sederman, we might find that you don't get balancing equilibria.
Absolutely. And they
and some of them are not. I don't think any of them are outright false, but I think that many of them are not universally descriptive of the way that actual international politics works.
Goes to the question of whether these are actually analytical assumptions. See, I'm not even sure it's a model.
But that's the only way you could salvage this claim, right, that these are assumptions. And
no, that would be the way to salvage the claim. I'm not interested in salvaging the claim. He's making a set of empirical claims, which he thinks are true, and then he's going to run with them. And if he is correct about those claims being true, then the question is, do these sorts of behaviors actually follow from those claims? And I don't think they do. That's when we get later to talk about the response pieces. I mean, that's Wendt's point, right? That even you could take those same assumptions and you don't necessarily end up with the results that Mearsheimer thinks that you do. But no, I mean, there is confusion here between a set of descriptive claims that I'm going to posit as being accurate for the sake of my argument and a set of analytical claims where I really don't care about the truth value of them, but what I'm interested in is what they do in terms of making the model work. And I don't think he's operating in the second register at all.
So that was page 10, and we're now on to page 11. The two things that are important here are labeled first and second. There is a lot of ordinal numbering of points here, which is quite useful if you want to take notes, mm-hmm, or write a crib sheet if you had this on an exam. But he says that, you know, the things that follow from this is that states in the international system fear each other. They are afraid. They are worried about being conquered. They are not in international politics is not simply an economic marketplace because physical survival is on the line. You can be killed.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually also be killed at a market. Second, each state in the international system aims to guarantee its own survival, which I thought was an assumption of the theory.
That was an assumption. But, that was
right, but now it's an empirical implication, mm-hmm, of the assumption. And then third, this is the kind of Waltzian move, self-help, blah, blah, blah. Alliances are not an example of cooperation that are supposed to create a problem for realism, mm-hmm, because alliances are only temporary marriages of convenience, where today's alliance partners might be tomorrow's enemy. Today's enemy might be tomorrow's alliance partner. If you know things about the history of alliances in the sovereign state system, you will know that they are, the term that Wolforth uses is alliances are not frictionless. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was a huge honking deal when Austria shifted from alliance with the UK in the 18th century to France. It was called the diplomatic revolution for a reason. And it was hard to do, and there were many people in court who opposed it stridently. I do wonder often if that simple observation about alliances being sticky, even in realism, might be a bigger problem, you might think.
Right.
So then he says, and this is the part that I thought was just kind of worth noting, that he has a third assumption, which is essentially offensive realism, that states maximize their relative power.
Mm-hmm.
And he points out that this is not the assumption of Waltz. It's not the assumption made by defensive realism, but it is his assumption.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that raises another issue, which is he testing international institutions against defensive realism or against offensive realism? Because it'll turn out that many of the reasons why international cooperation fails make a lot more sense if states are power maximizing than if they are defensive positionless.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes when we have examples of successful cooperation, it looks like the argument is similar to the argument you get in defensive positionalism. Right? Well, that cooperation isn't really all that consequential, or there's some mutuality of interest, right? Which is actually not what you would expect in a world where states were maximizing power. They were so always out to dominate one another. Those kinds of situations would be much rarer,
mm-hmm,
than they would be in defensive realism. So, mm-hmm, I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, especially since, I mean, he's pretty clear about it there on page 12. All states are influenced by this logic, which means not only that they look for opportunities to take advantage of one another, but also that they work to ensure that other states do not take advantage of them. So it has to be active. It's got to be going on all the time. So, which is interesting because he said earlier, you can never be sure of state's intentions, but then he interprets that to mean, therefore, you should assume the worst at all times.
Randy Schweller and Jennifer Mitzen, or Jennifer Mitzen and Randy Schweller, I don't remember who the first author is, have a really nice piece about how it's a critique of kind of defensive realism, but it's an argument that security dilemmas aren't uncertainty, they're false certainty. Do you know the piece I'm talking
about?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, essentially that what happens in the spiral model is that you become convinced that the other side is out to get you when they are, were not really initially.
Mm-hmm.
You're right. On face, uncertainty could produce a false sense of certainty that everybody is maximizing power and out to get you, or it could produce a false sense of security that states aren't ever out to get you. Or if, in fact, states are likely to follow mixed strategies, thus producing uncertainty, it could produce a world where you expect mixed strategies and you pay a lot of attention to type.
And the Robert Axelrod argument about the evolution of cooperation through diffuse reciprocity, in fact, depends on uncertainty about the other's intentions. And that uncertainty, that's real uncertainty, not worst case scenario uncertainty, but real uncertainty, means you have the possibility of reading based on behavior and therefore being able to negotiate your way into a positive equilibrium. So that uncertainty can go in a bunch of different directions. It's that assumption of, it's the worst case assumption, which sort of comes out from the worst case assumption that Mearsheimer argues on page 12 that states have to make, necessarily make, does not follow quite so clearly from what he's laid out up to that point.
But nonetheless, right, I mean, it is a position,
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know, and he runs it as hard as you can, and that's kind of what Mearsheimer's about.
Yeah.
That being said, I think we should name check here Brian Rathbun's Uncertainty About Uncertainty piece from ISQ in 2007, I want to say. I'm not sure exactly from when, but that's a piece that just kind of points out that uncertainty is used in a lot of different ways in IR, a lot of different ways in realism, and distinguishes between uncertainty, that Knight-y uncertainty, where you can't actually assign probabilities to potential outcomes, and standard uncertainty, where you are assigning probabilities under conditions of incomplete information.
Well, and if we're looking into that area, Adam Lerner actually has a really nice piece on Trumpian unpredictability that just appeared in, where was it? Was it in International Relations? No, it was in Cambridge. It was in the Cambridge Review of International Affairs.
There's a piece in Security Studies there's a piece that goes out and says, okay, well, does the madman theory actually work? Let's look at cases.
Mm.
Which is kind of interesting. You know, in other words, does a reputation for being crazy actually enhance your ability to do coercive diplomacy effectively? I can't remember what the answer is, but the answer I think is conditional. It depends on
Roseanne McManus?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. Revisiting the Madman Theory. There's a 2019 article.
See, Trump was good for something, right?
Hey, sometimes being frustrated and pissed off is the best way to stimulate yourself into writing. Clearly, that's what happened to Mearsheimer.
Cooperation in the realist world. What here is interesting. It's he introduces the relative gains argument.
Yeah, I mean it's. You know, you can have cooperation if you're able to somehow deal with relative gains problems. Cooperation won't happen very often because it's hard to deal with these things. Teaming up to protect each other from a threat outside that threatens both of you doesn't violate the expectations of the theory. It's the basic kind of logic. I didn't find much there that struck me as particularly novel, sort of his realist arguments that we've heard lots of times. You know, don't rely on your allies to come and save you because remember Poland in 1939, right? How many times does that show up in realist pieces?
And frankly, these arguments are going to get repeated later, mm-hmm. so we don't even need to unpack them or talk about their context or anything now. The only note I have on page 12 is this is so early 1990s.
Yeah.
Already by 1996, there was a way in which this was a little stale, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. So the one thing, though, that I think is noteworthy is after the Poland, after where he invokes Poland, rivals as well as allies cooperate. After all, deals can be struck that roughly reflect the distribution of power and satisfy concerns about cheating. The various arms control agreements signed by the superpowers during the Cold War illustrate this point. I don't understand this argument at all. Right? I mean, I understand the point of the argument. I understand how it follows from anything he's just said.
Well, if realists, if a state is concerned in his kind of realism with relative gains and not thinking in terms of absolute gains, and if concerns about cheating were taken off the table, and parenthetically, I'm not quite sure how you would have an agreement. Concerns about cheating would be taken off the table, and arms control agreements do not.
Verification.
Yeah, I was going to say arms control agreements don't strike me as a good example of that, because the only way they take cheating concerns off the table is by creating, I don't know, what's the word, an institution that monitors things and exchanges information in exactly the way that regime theorists say that they're supposed to.
You mean like the Open Skies Treaty that we pulled out of under the Trump administration because reasons?
Yeah. Yeah, like something like that. So,
right. I mean, this is essentially the liberal. This is essentially liberal institutionalism is true.
Right. Right.
I mean, we should just go home now. The article's over. Under conditions that look like liberal institutionalist conditions, you can get cooperation.
Ta-da. Mm-hmm.
Now, to be fair, the argument is that those conditions are less frequent. Right. Than liberals assume, and that is the crux of the perennial, venerable, and perhaps interminable realist liberal debate. Nonetheless, I don't think realists are providing any answer either to the conditions under which that would happen. And so I'm not that sympathetic when that becomes an argument.
But it's a weird negative argument. It's like realism says these things can't happen under these sorts of conditions. But if you actually had these other sorts of conditions, I guess there would be nothing stopping it, and therefore it might just randomly show up because suddenly you'd remove the barriers to it. But that's not a positive argument for why you would have it. It's not actually an explanation of why you would have things like arms control agreements. Like, wouldn't you, if you run with his logic, wouldn't you just have armed states kind of looking at each other in like a Hobbesian anarchy, right?
If states were as concerned about relative gains as he claims that they are, the risk of cheating, the risk of the verification regime failing, should prevent arms control. You would only get it under very, very limited circumstances where cheating would be so obviously detectable that it would be pointless to say that you couldn't verify it. What those situations are, I don't know.
I don't know, but I know that what they're not is arms control, especially with nuclear weapons.
Right. I know they're not New START. Now, there was a lot of verification stuff built into New
START. Absolutely.
Intrusive verification of the type that states that are worried about relative gains and jealous of their sovereignty might not normally do. Just saying. Mm-hmm. All right. So, I mean, but this is the issue. Realists aren't idiots. Mearsheimer is certainly not an idiot. They know there's cooperation out there. And so they have to deal with it in some way. And it's just, and this gets back to Ron's point, or to going back to like the Jervis stream of arguments or some of the other people we mentioned, it would be, might have been more productive during this period for realists to focus more on explanations for when you do get cooperation. And there are lots of interesting arguments, some of which Mearsheimer himself has made, I don't know in writing, but in public. So, for example, there is a very interesting argument, and I think an argument that is probably true, that the provision of security hierarchy by the United States in Europe took security dilemmas off the table sufficiently, not completely, but sufficiently to allow, create a permissive environment for European unification. Mm-hmm. That is a realist theory of, a very straightforward realist theory of cooperation that says, in conditions of hegemony or in conditions of security hierarchy, short of what we think of as hegemony, you can get very robust cooperation. He will later say that hegemony is a realist theory of cooperation. There are all sorts of issues with the way that hegemony theories interact with this form of realism, it's complicated, right? Because this form, offensive realism predicts, without the stopping power of Lauder, lots of hegemony. Mm-hmm. It's just, I guess, regional hegemony. And because it predicts a lot of hegemony, you should get a lot of cooperation under the umbrella of hegemony. It might be coercive, more or less coercive. But at least that's like a positive theory that you could run, and then you could, I guess, in this manner that he wants to do, test against.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times when he's talking later on about cooperate, this other kinds of like, oh, well, they just happen to be able to cooperate because there weren't really too many barriers to it. You know, these are cases like Britain and France, and you just want to say, well, just say it's because they're in the U.S. security system.
Right.
Right. Just make everybody's life easier.
Mm-hmm.
Do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, but he can't, because he actually, another argument he makes, he can't do that. So then he says institutions of the realist world. And this is, of course, one of the great examples where maybe realists have egg on their face, or maybe we should just keep waiting. It's going to happen someday because nothing lasts forever. He says at the bottom of page 14, you know, he says realists are a mirror of the balance of power. They're temporary, yada, yada, yada. And he says, NATO provides a good example of realist thinking about institutions. NATO is an institution. It certainly played a role in preventing. This is actually, I think I read this sarcastically, but actually this is, I think, supposed to be, I think this is, the tone of this is more jocular, right?
Mm-hmm.
NATO is an institution,
mm-hmm.
and it certainly played a role in preventing World War III and helping the West win the Cold War. Nevertheless, NATO was basically a manifestation of the bipolar distribution of power in Europe during the Cold War. It was that balance of power, not NATO per se, that provided the key to maintaining stability on the continent. NATO was essentially an American tool for managing power in the face of the Soviet threat. Now, with the collapse of the Soviet Union, realists argue that NATO must either disappear or reconstitute itself on the basis of the new distribution of power in Europe. NATO cannot remain as it was during the Cold War. It's true that it did not remain how it was.
Mm-hmm.
It expanded. It redefined its mission as a democratic peace community.
Yeah. None of which would be consistent with the kind of realism that Mearsheimer is espousing.
I don't think that's what he means.
No, I'm pretty sure it's not what he means. I mean, I think a couple things about that that occurred to me. First of all, he's writing that it's 94, 95. So this is the era of the North Atlantic Cooperation Council. This is the era at which there's a big move to try to bring the Russians into NATO.
Yeah, the NATO-Russian Council.
So this is the idea that you can expand what had been happening between allies in NATO to other countries who had been former adversaries, and you could sort of create peace and stability that way. So clearly that's not the kind of transformation of the alliance that he's interested in. But, you know, it's a example of NATO trying to kind of reach out and do a number of other things. I'm curious about two things in that paragraph, though. First of all, I don't quite understand what he means when he says, now with the collapse of the Soviet Union, realists argue that NATO must either disappear or reconstitute itself. He didn't say will either disappear or reconstitute itself. He says must. So what is that? Kind of a normative imperative? Is that a prescription? What is he doing there exactly? So it's a very strange word. The other one that strikes me as kind of interesting in here is a little earlier when he's talking about NATO, where he sort of admits that somehow, in some undefined way, NATO played a role in preventing World War III. Okay, by his own theory, what role could NATO possibly have played? Because it's an epiphenomenal manifestation of the balance of power. So what would it have done? But he qualifies. It was the balance of power in Europe during the Cold War. It was that balance of power, not NATO per se, that provided the key to maintaining stability on the continent. I'm not quite sure what NATO per se means in that sentence. What would it mean to say that NATO per se had an effect on something, as opposed to the balance of power or the distribution of capabilities that's organized in the alliance?
If you want to see a more contemporary version of this kind of argument, I think it was Charles Glaser had a piece in International Security attacking the assumptions of kind of liberal. It's a realist critique of LIO, that is liberal international order theory.
What is that?
I mean, it's sort of the policy. It's you know, it's John Eikenberry, right? That's what it is, right? It's John.
Okay.
He's critiquing John, okay? And in the extent that John's views are based on assumption in a lot of the policy community.
Okay.
That's what he's arguing with. And it's the same thing. It's not their liberal institutions that made the difference. It was all the balance of power. Liberal institutions were more or less epiphenomenal. I mean, the thing, it's just, this is just kind of nutty because NATO was doing exactly the kinds of things that liberal institutionalists say institutions do. It was enabling coordination. It was providing information. Mm-hmm. So reducing transaction costs of monitoring. It was doing work that constructivists say it has to do, like legitimizing security hierarchy. It was making a situation that was extremely unequal look more fair and equitable. It's just weird. I'm going to say weird and odd a lot for the rest of this podcast.
Yes. I think weird and odd is a good way to characterize, especially what's coming next.
It doesn't matter because it was essentially a tool for managing power. Well, yes, institutions are supposed to be ways of managing power.
Yeah.
And if it was a good tool, then why was it a good tool? Why have it at all? Liberal institutionalism, as he's describing it, is kind of the same stew that you might have heard of as neoliberal institutionalism, the economistic logics of cooperation, which are all oriented towards saying, okay, even if we assume anarchy in rational, self-interested actors, there are various strategies and means and conditions that can produce fairly durable consequential cooperation. As you know, I don't think it's really an internal critique of Waltz, but it is certainly an internal critique of whatever realists take those assumptions on. Mm-hmm. And so we spent a lot of time arguing over the prisoner's dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of time. And that was like high theory.
Yep.
For a while.
Yep.
This theory never gets operationalized beyond what happened in the 80s and early 90s in any really sustained way, because you move very quickly into open economy politics and other kinds of things where you're maintaining the same kinds of models of action, but much more about domestic politics. You're not even arguing anymore whether cooperation is possible, because it clearly is in your domain. You're seeing the WTO, you're seeing all these things going on, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's just not that interesting. You're more interested in why states sign on, and whether signing on to an agreement really has an effect, or whether it's epiphenomenal because they, you know, would have behaved that way anyway. So you're interested in those kinds of things. And so liberalism does not call itself liberalism anymore. It's just kind of baked into a set of assumptions that happen in a lot of IP.
I think that's fair. Well, I should note that it is important that in the long footnotes for the liberal institutionalism section, he does cite his second and third woman. So we do actually have two more women now showing up. That would be Helen Milner.
So there are four. That we found. I don't know how much this says about Mearsheimer and how much this says about international security and its world 95.
And frankly, how much it says about whatever the citation norms of the field in 1994. So.
Yeah, I'm sure nobody even... I mean, this just wasn't on the radar screen.
And the fact that, well, and as we'll point out later on, the hodgepodge of critical theory doesn't even really include feminism as a separate thing. So collective security. So it's weird because he presents collective security as if collective security was a theory. And back to this question of the strange ambiguity of how he uses the word theory here sometimes. If liberalism and liberal institutionalism or neoliberal institutionalism is at least a theory, an explanation of why certain things happen in the world. Collective security is not really a theory. Collective security is a set of recommendations about the ways that things could happen. So you could set up certain kinds of institutions, and if you set these things up, then certain things would occur. But collective security is a way of describing a set of policies and practices, not really a theory of why those things work. And the kind of collective security that he's interested in here is a very specific flavor of collective security the automatic response kind of collective security. So if we are in a collective security arrangement, then it means that we have all agreed to come to the aid of an attack on any one of the members or an attack by any one of the members. We will go in and intervene against them, and it's automatic and doesn't have any discretion attached to it. So we will be in there to enforce security, enforce the violation of peace by coming to the aid of whoever has been attacked. There's another interesting ambiguity that floats around in here, though, because it's unclear. Sometimes Mearsheimer talks about collective security as being about preventing war, and other times he talks about it as being a means of achieving stability, and I'm not quite sure what the relationship is between the two of those things, between the absence of war and the presence of stability, or whatever he actually means by that. But collective security seems to be a way that states can agree to not look at, in Mearsheimer's estimation, to not look after their own security interests, but to have security be maintained by the group. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I just have my notes to say, is collective security a theory or an outcome goal?
Yeah.
I mean, really, he's just arguing with Kupchin and Kupchin here, with Charlie and
which is Kupchin. Then signaled in the response piece that the Kupchins will then write to the part of that. Right. So we'll talk about that a little next. When his discussion of the concert, though, when he got to that, I actually had my one note on that was obviously written long before Jennifer Mitzen's book on the concert. So they had, just as one example of more recent scholarship on how the concert worked. I mean, his target is the Kupchins, but just important also to note someone else whose name never comes up when you ask people to remember IR theorists from the early part of the 20th century, but somebody who was hugely important at the time is Innes Claude. And Claude's Swords into Plowshares is sort of his real target here in terms of thinking about collective security arrangements. So,
right, that's why it's really much Back to the Future.
Mm-hmm.
Really,
mm-hmm.
Really Back to the Future. So then he has his critical theory thing, and that's the first of my many notes that say, PTJ's not going to like this.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, I just remember reading this piece.
We're on page 14 and 15, by the way.
I remember reading this for the first time, and this article quickly became like the red flag that was being waved in front of the bull. And looking back on it now, it's almost comical, the kind of caricature of non-realist, non-liberal approaches that he kind of shoves together under this heading of critical theory. I mean, we say all the time that one of the problems with the isms debates and the notions of the paradigms is it imposes consistency where there isn't actually consistency, and it shuts down on internal pluralism and so on. Mearsheimer's critical theory category makes a mockery of that. I mean, the stuff he's thrown together there to try to make into something called critical theory is just insane. I mean, you put all of these things together and you have a general note that says, I'm trying to look for the exact moment where he says, okay, yes, there are some differences between critical theorists here, but... And then he wants to try to draw out some idealist notion that somehow all of critical theory is about people thinking the world good. But he's thrown together things that really don't go together in any meaningful way except by not being realist.
I mean, let's cut to the chase. This is an era where people thought, if you run off a ledge, aren't you subject to gravity, is a good argument against constructivism or social constructionist claims. This is an era where people legitimately said, how are ideas going to change the tank that's rolling at you? You can't think the tank away, as if it's a stunning retort.
I mean, maybe. It's. I mean, but just look at... I mean, look at footnote 128. I mean, good Lord.
then goes into liberal institutionalism. And actually, there's really only a very small number of arguments here that are, as I mentioned at the beginning, are repeated a number of times. Mm-hmm. The way that I understand his argument is, A, liberals get things wrong because states care a lot about relative gains, that liberals admit that their theory doesn't apply in security, but aha, hoisted by your own petard, economics have security implications. So therefore, it shouldn't work in economics either. I think that's pretty much it.
That does seem to be... That's the gotcha.
He runs through his description of liberal institutionalism, which really emphasizes Cohen's concession to realism in this argument. And this is a sort of important move in the mid-80s. I imagine it started sooner than that because... You know, we always like to talk about this road that liberalism didn't take, and this is the road from the 70s, and it's the road that starts in the early 70s with a lot of emphasis on transnationalism. Then the first edition of Power and Independence, the argument of there's the realist world and there's the complex interdependence world, and here are the reasons why realism doesn't apply in the complex interdependence world. So you could have taken that trajectory. Cohen makes this move to attack realists on their own grounds and with some, you know, clever applications of economic concepts. And then for some reason, that's like what goes off to the races. And there is still this interdependent stuff in the background. There are people who are certainly studying the effects of interdependence as a variable. There are a couple of people who are doing things, but it's really kind of, I think, recently that there's been something of a renaissance of a return to interdependence notions as something that we care a lot about. I don't know. So he goes through this. You can solve the prisoner's dilemma if you play a multiply iterated game, and you can, because and he doesn't actually explain it that elegantly, but I mean, essentially in a infinitely iterated prisoner's dilemma, when you sufficiently care about the long term, you can afford to see if the other side defects, that is, identify what type it is. Once you move into mutual defection as a result of identifying its type, those gains get washed out. Their effect on the overall sum of the utility functions is not very high. And then there's a series of debates about, you know, well, does it have to be infinitely iterated? Because if you can identify a final move, you should defect on that move, and it then unravels backwards. You know, he basically just kind of boils it down to its most clearly worded essence. Is there some weird phrasings here? The key to solving this dilemma is for each side to convince the other that they have a collective interest in making what appears to be short-term sacrifices. But if they convince each other to cooperate, there's no short-term sacrifice.
Yeah.
If they're both cooperative types, you just get cooperation. And then you play fit for tat. And you cooperate. And yay, we're all like hugs and bunnies and unicorns. And then this means convincing states to accept the second best outcome. Convincing states? Who's doing the convincing here? The idea is that if we take realist assumptions, we should see this kind of behavior within realism, if you have generally rational actors. This idea that somehow, like, it's actually liberal institutionalists whispering in the ears of Madeleine Albright, getting her to do things by convincing her about short-term losses. It goes back to what you said. I don't know. I mean, what is this? Is it prescriptive? Is it descriptive?
Yeah, it's unclear. He keeps going back and forth between, as we've said, between the sort of explanatory theory side of things and the policy making preferences, perhaps operating as false consciousness side of things. So are the liberal institutionalists, is that an account of a particular approach to international relations that he thinks is just not valid in the light of realism? And if it's not valid, then how else do you explain these sorts of things that states are actually doing? And then you have to get back to the idea that somehow they are just deluded. But then if states can be so easily deluded, then what exactly is the force of these supposed necessary realist imperatives that states are supposed to be following? I get rather confused in trying to follow that logic.
So on page 18, he then makes this weird pivot. Now we're talking about institutions, but we're supposed to be talking about rules. His definition of institutions. And you have this argument that rules can increase the number of transactions between particular states over time. None of what he says in the remainder of the paragraph is exactly wrong, but it is kind of a hash of a bunch of arguments.
But what's also strange is that the notion of rule changes over the course of page 18, right? Sometimes it's essentially referring to behavioral regularities. Sometimes it's a way of arranging sets of interactions. Sometimes it's a rule in the more conventional sense of a rule being a written standard. And he sort of goes back and forth between these different definitions of rules over the course of those 4 points. And I don't quite know what he's talking about some of the time. So we have rules that can somehow tie interactions together to create issue linkage, but then you have a rule that can reduce transaction cost, but it's not the rule that reduces the transaction cost, it's the use of the rule that reduces the transaction cost. So I'm unclear as to exactly what he means by rules on this page. And I think, though, that if we pull back from the technical question, or the more sort of philosophical question of what he means by rule or what rule might mean, what he's opposed to is the idea that there can be mutual understandings between states that would somehow mitigate power competition. And the details are less important than the restatement of the overarching, no, it's a competitive environment out there and states can't do anything that's going to prevent them from having to continually power struggle with each other. Because ultimately that stuff's going to break down.
Then he gets to the flaws in the causal logic, and my notes are, he keeps on calling disagreements over empirical wagers flaws in causal logics. And so the first flaw is that states care about relative gains.
Yep.
I mean, look, the payoff structure may still be a prisoner's dilemma, even if they care about relative gains. It's not that you either only care about relative gains or only care about absolute gains. You care about a mix of them. And that mix would presumably be in your utility function, right? Moreover, fundamentally, like, the argument here is just that states are at the Pareto frontier. Okay, yeah, when states are at the Pareto frontier, you're not in a prisoner's dilemma. None of the stuff applies.
Right. Right.
So the whole point of prisoner's dilemma is that it's Pareto inefficient. You do have an outcome which increases both players' utilities. And that's the mutual cooperation outcome. That's why the game is interesting. If relative gains are affecting the payoff structure such that you can't improve without, somebody can't improve without reducing the other person's utility, it's just not, you're not in the game anymore. This is not relevant. So the question becomes empirically, where are you when? It's not that institutionalism is wrong. It's not that realism is wrong. It's that they describe different settings. I know that he invokes some empirical cases. He does some argumentation, but ultimately this is all question begging. Because realist assumptions are true, we are always in the setting where liberal institutionalism is wrong. I mean, I'll go further. I mean, you know that in my first book, I credited a Peter Bierman lecture that was a rethinking of that was a rethinking of Charles Tilly's CatNet collective mobilization framework. So one of the things that Peter really pointed out is that if you took the argument seriously, it turns out that the liberal solution to the collective action problem is about essentially taking a setting that has certain characteristics and changing the characteristics of that setting. And where liberal institutionalism does make a claim that is anti-realist, I think, is that what institutions can do is they can change the features of the structural context of the interaction. And they do that by doing things like ensuring plenty of interaction, which allows for all sorts of increases in information, reduction in uncertainty. It allows for monitoring of various sorts. You know, it does things that essentially remove the atomistic structure that inhibits collective action and creates a denser network structure. You know, so what it does is it solves the problem that comes from having sparse social ties that has to do with collective mobilization. And then you move over to what would be how critical theory could have been done right, and it's about collective identification, removing the heterogeneous interests that are a barrier to collective action. So anyway, yes. So, okay, yes, when you're not in a liberal institutionalist environment, you won't get liberal institutionalism. He is very comprehensive. I have some notes where, I'm like, Jervis on the security dilemma, but then he does talk about it later. He invokes strategic trade theory in the mid-90s, which is odd because everybody abandoned strategic trade theory because they didn't think it was true.
Oh,
Remember
yes.
Mark Bly's discussion of this? They get together in 84 and they're going to have a trade policy and they look at strategic Krugman's there and they're going to look at strategic trade theory and they're going to use that and that's going to be their economic policy against Reagan, and then they decide it's not true, so they're not going to use it. But in politics, it doesn't matter whether economic theory is true, it just matters if you have a story. So I don't know why we're talking about strategic trade theory here. Like, no idea. I mean, I don't know. I mean, he does score some points that some of the examples that get batted around in these debates aren't that great for cooperation. I think, ironically, you have actually a lot of stronger arguments on the security side sometimes than you do in some of these economic situations. But even then, I mean, I think, it's just, I don't know. I mean, I can't evaluate some of these cases. Like, I don't know whether Japanese and American frictions over HDTV standards disproves the ability to cooperate internationally when relative gains are at stake. Like, the standard isn't different. I'm sorry. I mean, as far as I know, we're all on similar HDTV platforms. The main thing you would do with an HDTV model is you swap out the power supply, as far as I know. So I guess
Somehow.
we solved it.
Although the we that solved it weren't any states cooperating. It was international standards setting and voluntary agreements by manufacturers, which none of that shows up here.
The world runs on private standard setting agencies that somehow get together and do things like internet protocols and how shipping containers, what the size of a shipping container is, and all these other things that make the world that we exist in possible. Craig Murphy is really good on this. If you ever get him to sit down and kind of give a spiel on like the origins of international cooperation and the UN system, most of international cooperation, as you point out, is very robust standard setting, without which almost nothing that you and I are sitting here doing today would be possible. Somehow that happens. Somehow that happens, despite the fact that there are enormous relative stakes there. We live in a world that is, in many ways, much more liberal institutionalist than realist, when you look at the sort of nuts and bolts of the everyday world. That's the claim I'm going to make.
I would tweak it slightly. Because I wouldn't, well, it depends. If we're talking about liberal institutionalists, like being the pre-neoliberal institutionalist stuff. If that's what you mean, then I would agree with you.
I'm not saying it's a world that is explained by a simulation of the prisoner's dilemma in which the tit for tat strategy did pretty well, right? I'm not talking about that, right? But I am saying we're living in a world that is made possible by a large amount of cooperation that we take to be, it's
Agreed,
just, it's so
agreed.
everyday
I
we don't
think
even
though
notice
that
it.
the slight amendment to that or slight extension of that I would make is it's a world of cooperation that is not exclusively a world of interstate cooperation. And
Well, that's not a
no,
good thing
but
for realists either.
Mearsheimer's argument is entirely about states and what states do and don't do. And his criticisms of neoliberal institutionalism are all about state cooperation. And in fact, even his collective security and his critical theory category are all about states acting. Whereas a lot of the negotiation and standards setting that you were just referencing, which I would completely agree with, is it's private standard setting. It's other kinds of actors. It's much more diffuse.
Let me, though, restate that. If these arguments were true, states
That I
would
would agree
never
with.
let that happen.
That I would agree with.
This paragraph that you referenced before, just for listeners, is on page 25, where he points to a bunch of examples of successful cooperation under situations that have, I would assume, have relative gains implications, and which, involve cooperation with at least security stakes. And his so the examples being that Lisa Martin's example, the European Community facilitates a united economic sanctions front from Britain's allies. So his objections are that British efforts to maintain EC sanctions were not impeded by fears of possible cheating. which the theory identifies as a central impediment to cooperation. So it's not an important test of liberal internationalism. Also, neither side's core interests were threatened. Neither side's core interests were threatened. I'm going to say that again. Neither side's core interests were threatened. And neither side had to make significant sacrifices to reach an agreement. So there are core interests now and peripheral interests. And you can trade away peripheral interests without fears of relative gains dynamics, I guess.
And it's only significant sacrifices you can't make. You can make moderate sacrifices, apparently.
And then the EC was not essential to an agreement because they could have been linked without the EC. That's a relevant counterfactual. I would like to work through it. It just might be possible that British efforts to maintain EC sanctions were not impeded by fears of possible cheating because of the EC.
Maybe, yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it isn't, right? I would like to hear some arguments about that. And then that the U.S. did it anyway, so clearly the EC doesn't matter, which, I mean, I guess...
He also keeps moving the goalposts a little bit, because it now is no longer enough that the behavior be sort of predicted by the theory, but also the process to get to the behavior has to be predicted by the theory. So we're slipping between levels of evidence and kinds of claims and the ways in which one would try to evaluate them. So it really is, it's not even a moving target. It's just a sort of vague target.
So, So collective security.
This is the I mean, it's interesting. I have very little to say about this because I think that you know, we already highlighted the main problem here, which is that collective security is not really a theory. Collective security is an outcome, and it's an outcome that one is supposed to achieve in various ways, and the approaches to collective security that he is unhappy with are approaches that say that states can act in any way other than worrying about maximizing their relative gains vis-a-vis one another. And because he's already kind of presumed that's true, then obviously anything that says states could act in a different way must therefore be false, and therefore collective security doesn't work. That sort of seems to be the argument. So get to page 30, and he talks about how important trust is. And he says that, you know, states have to trust each other. They have to be confident that almost all the other states in the system will sincerely renounce aggression and will not change their minds at a later date. Except that's actually not part of what certainly Innes Claude said about collective security, which exactly said that you don't trust that all the other states are going to renounce aggression, which is why you have a collective security agreement to say that if anybody does commit aggression, then you're going to come together to enforce the peace. So, in fact, the whole system is premised on the idea that not everybody has actually abandoned aggression. This is not the attempt to outlaw war. That's not what collective security means. But he's pushed this collective security thing into such an unrealistic set of assumptions about what might possibly motivate state action that there's almost no way it could possibly be true. So it's really a caricature.
And that's why it's uninteresting. Right. I agree that the collective security agreement designed by my undergraduates with the maximum legal binding, whatever, I agree that won't work. The thing that I think we both think has some interest here is the discussion of the concert system. I mean, and I think we've said really what needs to be said there, which is that it would be nice to have a little bit more texture to support the claim that this was really just about balance of power politics, and that the concert did nothing of importance to maintain the peace. That in the absence of the concert, we would have had the same outcomes.
Well, and on page 36, he has this bizarre little paragraph Concerts usually last only a few years. The balance of power changes. Defeated powers rise from the ashes. Victorious powers squabble among themselves, especially about how to deal with minor powers. States become less sensitive to the costs of war as time passes. That last sentence in particular is like, wait, hold on. Right.
Well, that's Jervis's argument.
But then Mearsheimer wants that to be an argument that supports his position, but his position is that states can't become less sensitive to the costs of war because the costs of war always have to be this constant worst-case scenario. So you couldn't actually modify these things. And even if the concert only lasts a few years, I'm not sure why a concert that lasts a few years isn't an argument that states are capable of behaving in ways that are not a worst-case scenario. Like, of course, if they can, even if it's just for a few years, they can. And so I'm not sure why that's a point in his favor.
Details.
You mean like the details in page 37 when we move to critical theory? There are some details.
Yeah, you go crazy
there.
Now.
I mean, and if you're not looking at the article, you've got to look at the article at this point. You've got to look at page 37.
Okay, so take out your PDF or your Xerox copy. Turn to page 37.
No.
You can't say we didn't warn you. Right. We did announce that this was the next thing we were doing.
And just look at footnotes 127 and 128. I mean, yes.
I have little pink exclamation
marks. And red marks and little stars and, you know, the whole Lucky Charm, stars, moons, clovers, everything is here. I mean, this is crazy. And there's two levels of crazy here. So level of crazy number one is that somehow everybody in footnotes 127 and 128 actually belong together on the same page. Now, it's interesting because if you look through what he's citing, particularly on 127, one of the synthetic discussions that he cites is the Pauline Rosenau book, Postmodernism and the Social Sciences.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah. And for those listeners who have not read Pauline Rosenau's 1994 book, was it 92, really?
1992.
Yes, it's 92.
Well, that's what it says here.
So, Rosenau's book should have been called Postmodernism Destroys the Social Sciences, A Field Guide to Evil, right? So it's the whole way is she's just basically saying, here's what you need to recognize as being like violations of the Enlightenment Project and bad things. So it's a very, shall we say, slanted portrayal of what is going on here. And if that is one of Mearsheimer's primary sources, kind of have to wonder about the narrative here. But the way that, because clearly he's not pulling that this kind of synthetic narrative from David Held's book, right, which is actually a reasonable synthetic kind of thing about the actual critical theory tradition, because Horkheimer to Habermas actually makes sense, because Horkheimer actually taught Habermas, and that's actually a thing in the Frankfurt School. That's actually a tradition called critical theory. So that one actually exists. But the footnote that's even crazier is 128, where you've got a laundry list of everybody. So, all right, let me give you footnote 128?
Just read it, yeah. You need to start with the text that precedes the citation.
In the footnote itself. Yes. Among the key works applying critical theory to international relations are... All right. So, Richard Ashley, The Poverty of Neorealism. Ashley's Geopolitics of Geopolitical Space. Robert Cox, Gramsci Hegemony and International Relations. Cox, Social Forces, States, and World Orders. Cox Toward a Post-Hegemonic Conceptualization of World Order. Kolowski and Kratochwill's Understanding Change in International Politics. Kratochwill and Ruggie's International Organization of State of the Art and the Art of the State. Ruggie Continuity and Transformation. Ruggie Territoriality and Beyond. Wendt, The Agent Structure Problem, which is the 87 piece. Wendt, Anarchy is What States Make of It, the 92 piece. And then Wendt, Collective Identity Formation of the International State, which is APSR. I use the label critical theory to describe this body of literature. Other labels are sometimes used, among them constructivism, reflectivism, postmodernism, and poststructuralism. The noise you just heard was the collective head exploding of large numbers of people putting... These things just do not at all belong together unless the standard that is operating here is stuff that isn't realism and liberalism.
And some of that stuff is liberalism, right? That's our conclusion about Wendt's strong liberalism.
Yes, and some of it is at least sort of reaching out toward that. But I mean, just even in the laundry list that I just gave there, these things do not belong together. They have nothing in common with each other except their rejection of methodologically kind of the search for nomothetic generalizations, but then theoretically a rejection of a state-centric rationalist understanding of things. Okay, but beyond that, they have very, very little in common with each other. Ruggie, in a couple of the pieces cited there, spends a little bit of time distancing himself specifically from Ashley. Ashley spends a lot of time distancing himself from Ruggie and from Cox, and also from what Wendt was starting to do. Wendt incorporates pieces of these things, but then distances himself from a number of them. So all of these folks are having lots of active debates and discussions internally. And what's even more ironic about this, in that entire footnote, there actually aren't any critical theorists. There is none of the Marxist and post-Marxist tradition of critical theory. Cox is a Gramscian, which is a different strain. There's no Habermasians in there. There's no Frankfurt School people.
That's true.
Right? There's none of kind of like critical theory per se in there. And what else isn't there? Gee, let me just take another look at that footnote real quick. Yeah, that's right. No feminism at all. Nothing of the other kind of critical traditions that are floating around here. You've got at least Cox as a Marxist, so you've got some Marxism. But there's no feminism there, right? And certainly, I mean, it would be problematic to expect there to be any kind of, like, post-colonial stuff in 1994-95. That wasn't really on the radar screen of most people. But there were feminist works floating around, and there was certainly feminist critical theory floating around at this point. Cynthia Enloe had been writing, there's other people who were there, and that's not referenced at all. So it's a weird way of cutting things up. It pushes things together, and then even more bizarrely, what he draws out of all of that is a kind of subjective idealism. Right? Because what he actually wants to argue that, and in the main text, what he argues that critical theory, as he calls it, is for, aims to transform the international system into world society where states are guided by norms of trust and sharing. Critical theorists, yes, drawn from a couple different things. Critical theorists take ideas seriously. They believe that discourse, or how we talk and think about the world, largely shapes practice. Roughly put, ideas are the driving force of history. So,
I've always considered Cox a Hegelian.
Sure, because that's exactly what production power and world order is about. I mean, that's sure. Wow. I guess the most charitable reading I could give of that would be something like, so much of the way that the mainstream US-centered Anglophone IR debate had been constructed was in terms of what it considered to be material factors, which it considered to be mind-independently objective drivers of behavior, that any claim that other things were important sort of only made sense in that intellectual cosmos as ideas. Even though that's, I'm looking at that footnote again, almost nobody in that footnote, I mean, maybe when, was arguing that ideas had some kind of independent causal force. For the most part, we're talking about practices, we're talking about processes of social construction, we're talking about collective meaning making, we're talking about things that don't involve subjective ideas in people's heads. I can sort of see how someone like Mearsheimer would have read that, though, would have interpreted it that way. It's a problematic reading, but I could sort of see how that might make sense in that particular cosmology. Remembering, too, that we're still operating in an era where, as you said earlier, people believe that if you step out of a window ledge, you'll fall, and there's gravity, and therefore social construction can't be true, was considered like a reasonable argument. So I guess you can sort of see why. I mean, the argument is nuts, but that's certainly the way that he plays it. What I also find interesting on page 38 is that then he goes on to take Ashley's admonition about, you know, play havoc with neorealist concepts and claims, and read that not as an instruction to theorists about how to theorize, but read that as an instruction to policymakers about how to conduct policy. Where Ashley was not speaking to policymakers and was not trying to argue that somehow we should just like not pursue realist policy. Instead, it was realism isn't a good account of the world, and so let us think about a different way of accounting for the world. You know, Ashley wasn't spending an awful lot of time telling policymakers what to do. So it's a very weird, there's a series of weird slippages here. And other than, I'll tell you, when I first read it, right, when I was in grad school and originally first read this, I think like many other people in my line of thinking were just basically incensed by the whole thing. It was like, oh my goodness, this is horrible. This is horrible. And what do we do? How do we sort of, you know, correct what people had to say about this? But looking back on it now, I can sort of understand, given the limitations of where he was coming from, why that's the way he would have read all of this work.
Is it even worth it to talk about his criticisms?
Because I don't even know what he's criticizing. This is back to a point we made earlier. What he's criticizing is the caricature of idealism that early interwar realists were criticizing. Because he's reduced all of this work to subjective idealism. We can think good thoughts about the world. We can have positive images of each other. We think good. We trust ourselves, trust each other, and therefore we can produce peace. So the names have changed. Some of the terms may have changed, but he's reading it as if it basically were that same construct that realists produced in the interwar period, or in the postwar period about the interwar period, to say, oh, there's this thing called idealism that we have to defeat. So all of this critical theory, quote unquote, becomes a form of idealism. And do I want to say this? Yes. Yes, I do want to say this. And Wendt's embrace of the term idealism at certain points in his writing didn't help, because that made it more plausible to be able to say, no, we are talking about something that sort of sounds like old-fashioned idealism. And for Mearsheimer, it sounds exactly like that. So that's really what he's arguing with here.
But it's not plausible to say that Cox is ever making an argument remotely like this.
Never. Never. No. Cox is not there. Ruggie is not there.
He's citing arguments about epistemic communities as evidence that this is supposed to be elite-driven change, when for some of the people he's talking about, they're primarily talking about academic discourse and debates within academia and opening up emancipatory space and language. There's an intertextuality claim that, you know, means it has some resonance beyond the academy, but that's kind of about it. For other people, you know, it's about the mobilization of social classes. I mean...
Because it's very much, and I went back and I looked at the Fisher article. The Fisher article is an argument that realism holds true in the medieval period because there were wars and conflicts, basically. And as Fritz Kratochwill and others, the Holland Kratochwill rebuttal, I think, was the best one, sort of pointed out, that's actually not the point. The point is not whether there was conflict. The point is whether you could identify things like discrete sovereign territorial units in medieval Europe, which you couldn't, and therefore theories based on discrete sovereign territorial units interacting in anarchy can't possibly explain anything about them, because the logic of those theories requires you to have discrete territorial units, which you didn't. So that doesn't make any sense. And that has nothing to do with ideas. That has to do with practices of organization. So, I mean, Fritz is not an idealist, and that was never the argument. But Marcus Fischer's discussion of this treated the alternative to realism as a kind of ideas make the world. You know, he says it, he's cited, Mearsheimer ends up citing him. What does he say? He says, Marcus Fischer makes this critical point. Yes, on page 40. In essence, critical theory holds that social reality is constituted by intersubjective consciousness based on language, and that human beings are free to change their world by a collective act of will.
It is not a defense of realism. This is something that Hendrik Spruit used to drill into us, if you remember, that the observation that there is conflict or war does not mean realism is true. Realism is a theory of why there is conflict and war. The opposite of realism is not peace. And in this context, what any of this has to do with the idea that institutions can allow us to ameliorate, attenuate, and even maybe transcend some of the limits of anarchy, it's just not relevant at all. Right. Now, there are other issues. The Fischer article focuses on a particular area of Europe at a particular time where there is particularly intense warfare between local lords. It is the case that if you wanted to look at medieval Europe and think about issues of ideas, you could look at things like the Peace of God movement and the effect that had on state formation and even on local levels of violence. I mean, even if we're sort of saying, okay, that the sovereign unit is like the guy with the independent military capability, which is the local lord, you still have to deal with the fact of authoritative obligation systems that actually get people to do things. You'd have to ask questions about, you want to ask questions about the Crusades, for example, if you wanted to start asking questions about the role of ideology in warfare. I know there are a lot of questions you could ask. This isn't one of them. It's orthogonal to the kinds of arguments that people like Rod Hall were making anyway. Right? None of them were saying that this was peaceful. They were talking about things like the Catholic Church as exercising power, despite not having tremendous military might in some of the areas it was exercising power, looking at practices of excommunication, politically salient high politics where there was no force involved, or military force, no kinetic force involved. So it's just weird. I mean, the fact that medieval Europe was peaceful is just not interesting.
Right. And yeah, it doesn't say anything to the theoretical debate at all. But it does speak to, or does allow Mearsheimer to make that claim that he has made a number of times in the piece, which is that realism somehow explains 700 years of the international system. Mm-hmm. Right? Because one of the claims here is realism has captured some fundamental truths about the way international politics works, and therefore the default assumption ought to be that realism is correct unless something can come along to disprove it. So this is part of the centering strategy of keeping realism at the center, of the kind of realism that he's interested in at the center. So that, I think, is the only kind of importance that he wants to draw out of that particular argument.
There's a very strange, after the discussion of, you know, this idea that, well, if realism has been dominant for so long, then obviously realism must be true, even though, you know, I don't know who was making those five assumptions of realism in 900. I don't know, right? I mean, but...
or how you could even tell.
In addition to this argument that critical theorists have to deal with the fact that realism is dominant, and the fact that it's dominant must mean it's true... interesting argument. He then has a discussion about how critical theorists are wrong about the end of the Cold War. And the reason that they're wrong about the end of the Cold War was that it was inevitable that he seems to be arguing here that the collapse of the Soviet Empire was inevitable because of the prohibitive costs of empire. I find that claim ridiculous on face. There is no reason the Soviet Union couldn't have kept chugging along the way that it did. It is possible that it would have had to loosen the strings on some of its Eastern European satellites, which it did from time to time. Right? Maybe Romania gets more Western loans to keep it afloat. I don't know. But this idea that somehow the end of the Cold War is explained by realism because retrospectively we can find objective reasons why Mikhail Gorbachev wanted to reform or decided to let the Eastern European satellites go is really the kind of worst example of the kind of stuff you were talking about. With not just realism, but any theory, you know, you could maybe make the same argument about certain kinds of economistic theories that just take their worldview to be true. You gotta show that. And you've gotta show that the fact that there are reasons that align with your theory does not make your theory true, and does not mean that those reasons would have inevitably been acted upon. And it does not mean, in the fact that Gorbachev may have invoked some reasons that are somewhat consonant with your theory, does not make your theory true. And this gets to this broader point, which is there's this fundamental issue with realism that shows up here, which is that realism, in many ways, takes the discourse of a certain type of political elite and then recasts it as an analytic theory, and then says, and then ramps up that theory to have a kind of internal causal logic, which is then supposed to explain behavior. Maybe when people justify their actions, they tend to point to a lot of different reasons, particularly when they're making policy arguments. And so you will always find some arguments that accord with your theory. Now, I think that, is it true? Is it wrong to say that maybe some claims about the role of transnational liberal internationalist epistemic communities, that they're maybe overplayed because the fact that Mikhail Gorbachev redeployed some of those ideas is probably not that consequential? Maybe. But the idea that there was anything inevitable about Reagan and Gorbachev deciding that they weren't actually the kind of adversaries they thought they were, and therefore they could do a lot of arms control and dial back the Cold War, that they really... that they didn't agree with each other, but they understood where they were coming from and understood that they began to see that their intentions toward one another were not fundamentally aggressive. But there's no reason that had to happen. There's no reason it had to happen when it happened. And there's no reason why it didn't, why if it didn't happen, you couldn't have had another hardline coup that would have held your hardline takeover or whatever that would have held things together. China put down all of its uprisings.
Right. No, there's nothing inevitable about this, and retroactively explaining outcomes that occurred by somewhat opportunistically finding traces of your preferred theory in the record just does not strike me as an especially good strategy. I mean, I would note that this is not just an issue that realists
have.
But I do think that you're right that there's something particularly tempting for realists about this, because it's true that a lot of the discourse of state interest in the contemporary era with sovereign territorial states interacting with each other has tended to be kind of realist discourse, because the structure of the system is about sovereign states interacting with each other. So, of course, they talk about things like national interests and relative power and so on and so forth. The fact that they do so doesn't mean that that's what explains their actions. But realists have a tendency, and particularly realists who are passing either back and forth between the policy and academic worlds or trying to stay close to the policy world from the academic side, I could see where that kind of confusion might raise itself.
Yeah, I mean, to be fair, he is not primarily quoting Gorbachev talking about why he's doing what he's doing in this context. It's just, it's a similar kind of impulse. You look for reasons that are consonant with your argument. And here it's just, you're doing, and here again too, he says that he then argues later something I completely agree with, which is that the collapse of the Soviet Empire is not some decisive test of like how world politics works at the level of is power politics going to go away? But the decisive test is actually whether or not realists have anything interesting to say about the nature and timing of the end of the Cold War, which is not retrospective reconstruction on their part. And if it, or that, or in this case, ironically, to discount the role of institutions or rules in that breakup, where there are a whole bunch of reasons why institutions are playing a super important role here, right? Arms control. You know, these are big examples of major arms, major symmetrical arms control agreements that require intrusive verification and are things where there's a high risk of cheating, right? This is a major reversal in, I mean, this is essentially a case of extremely high level relative gains, offensive realist readings of one another. We are afraid of one another. That gets reversed in 3 years. Right? That's what matters here, not the Soviet collapse. It's the end of the Cold War. And that's the role that institutions played in managing and mediating that whole process.
And as a lot of recent scholarship on things like the Helsinki Final Agreement have indicated, there are all sorts of ways that international institutions and indeed ideas about human rights helped to erode the legitimacy of different regimes, particularly regimes in the Eastern Bloc, which had signed on to commitments that they were not following. And there are implications that then follow from them not having done so. And this prompts the organization of different kinds of resistance movements internally and so on. So I think it's impossible to tell the story of the end of the Cold War without talking about institutions. But that fact does not necessarily count either for or against realism.
Well, it shouldn't.
Right, but what I'm saying is it shouldn't, and the fact that it is being read as if that somehow is an argument about realism is a real mistake. That's not really what we're talking about here. It's does realism as an explanatory theory have anything interesting to tell us about that
All right.
period? I mean, I can imagine a kind of realist reading of the Helsinki Final Act as being the human rights regime is a way of imposing certain kinds of norms and behavioral standards that produce a hierarchy of human rights adherence, and that can be thought of as a power
And
strategy.
this is the thing that's ultimately very frustrating about this kind of realism to me and to you, based on what you just said, which is that there is a whole tradition of realism which is about uncovering the power relations, the power interests, the power dynamics in things that are ostensibly not power political. So this is Carr's argument about Anglo-American morality. This is some of the, in fact, this is a lot of the skepticism, this is a whole another side of the skepticism of idealism. But this is how a lot of realists now are talking about liberal international order, right? That it's fundamentally all about power and domination under the cloak of morality. And what this direction of realism does is it basically takes all that real, it basically says that once you get into arguments like that, you are no longer realist, right? Because realism is not fundamentally about a critical theory of power relations, right? Of seeing the power politics that lie behind things in international politics that are ostensibly not power political. It is, in fact, a claim that those things just don't matter.
And once you've drawn the boundary lines that narrowly around realism, I start to wonder what realism has to say, except a reiteration of the same claim, which, as we've said several times throughout this discussion, is just basically a repetition of the same claim as was directed against supposed interwar idealism. It's just a repetition of the same thing, and there's really no new insight to be gained there. Now, if you go in that more critical direction, and if realism really becomes a way of unmasking the power political dimensions of things that don't appear to have power political goals, then you've got some interesting explanatory leverage. But of course, then you've also got something that would not be at all alien to actual critical theorists and actual post-structuralists. I mean, this is sort of Foucault's whole shtick. I mean, the whole reason why Foucauldian analyses of prisons and hospitals have the bite that they do is because they say these things appear to be benevolent, but check it out, they're not. I don't know, in a way that sounds kind of realist in spirit.
We need to stop
now. And that's
why
we need to stop.
You, 3 hours ago. It's an article, so it should probably only take a little bit. Not like the books, which we usually spend 3 hours on.